This is a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.
Tony Bruschi, thanks for joining us. Lori Vallow Daybell back in court again today. Let's go to the courtroom and take a listen.
You're absolutely allowed. I'm just trying to figure out. I'm sort of a gatekeeper, and I need to make sure witnesses have relevant information. And just like you have the right to interview all of the state's witnesses, excluding victims' rights, people that can deny having an interview, they have the right to interview all your witnesses prior to trial so they can have an idea of what those witnesses might say on the witness stand.
I understand that, Your Honor.
So
they also have already interviewed all of them.
I'm not talking about police interviews or interviews that may have been done years ago. The prosecutor has the right to interview any witness prior to them taking the stand, just as you do. So I'm not sure the best way to handle this other than maybe we should take it up as we progress through the case, but
Your Honor,
some of these people may or may not be even served.
Yeah, my concern is obviously I have attempted to reach these people. I've made my good faith effort. I've been told both by myself in attempting to contact them as well as the defense investigator that they've been unable to reach them. So it seems to not be following the rules of procedure or evidence to then bring up later on if they perhaps find these people at some point, then the state can try to at that point preclude them. When the state talks about a trial by ambush, it is in fact that. When the defense investigator themselves cannot find these people and are still looking for them in trial when they've had at least, we'll say, 4 months to try to find them, I think that at this point, precluding them is proper.
Well, I would preclude anyone that doesn't submit to an interview with the state. I kind of want to punt this a little bit just because if there's people that don't end up getting served, don't end up showing up at court, they can't find, then we don't need to waste our time talking about whether or not those people have relevant information because they're not going to be here and they're not going to testify. So I'm putting the defendant on notice that if these witnesses aren't served, if they don't submit to interviews, they're going to be precluded. Even if they submit to interviews, I may have to make a determination whether their testimony is relevant or not. So, again, we're going to, I think, have to cross that bridge when it comes. The state did say that they concede that some of the witnesses, Adam Cox, Janice Cox, Summer Shiflett, may have some minimally relevant information. The rest of these, I think we're going to have to take up maybe on a piecemeal basis, but I don't want it. It's not going to be a situation where you're ready to call them in as a witness the morning of, and then the state haven't been presented to the state for an interview prior to that. So keep that in mind when coordinating with your investigator. If he gets them served and they're actually going to be called at trial, they need to submit to an interview in advance of their testimony.
Your Honor, I understand that, and I am limited in what I can do. If I could call these people myself, they would answer my call probably, and I could have this discussion with them. But I'm going through the limitations that I have at the jail through my paralegal who's working overtime and my investigator who's working overtime to try to do everything to help me prepare for trial, as they have other clients as well that they have to do things in a timely manner for. So we are doing the best that we can.
Okay. All right. We next have defendant's motion to dismiss for violation of confidential communication and the Sixth Amendment dated March 18 of 2025 and the state's response. Let me ask the defendant first if you've received the state's response.
I did.
Did you say you did or didn't?
I did.
Okay.
Yes.
If you have an attorney in Idaho that is working on an appeal, it appears that the information that was turned over by the jail was some pretty innocuous messages about trying to set up the legal line to talk to you on a confidential line. And really, that's about it. So how does this arise to some sort of nefarious interception of things? Because it was put on a public chat system that the jail uses. You know it's not confidential. And you're told it's not confidential. And then even if I look at the substance of the messages, there's really nothing in the messages that would arise to some sort of confidential communication. Just trying to set up a meeting and get the recorded, unrecorded legal line set up.
Who's saying that they're not confidential?
Well, the
Who's
jail.
Telling me that they're not confidential?
Your own attorney, it looks like. Here's a message. I see that they came and got you. I'm working on getting a confidential attorney line set up. The implication being that this message is not confidential. The next one, again, just checking in. Hope things are getting a little better for you. I'm still working on getting a legal line set up. The implication is that these are not confidential.
Okay, so then he received a letter from MCSO that said, your phone number is now confidential and arranged for privileged, confidential, client privileged communications. So it says this phone number is connected to that. So from my perspective, when I call someone on the tablet or when I text someone on the tablet, it goes to their phone number. So all the communications after the date of the exhibit that we put in our motion, when he got that letter from MCSO that now all of your things will be confidential. Okay. Now they will be confidential. So my understanding, I'm the only one that can waive that privilege, right?
And I think after that, when his line was approved, there were no other disclosures of messages between you and him, correct?
No, there are.
You received other disclosures of intercepting messages between you and him?
So those go up to the 24th of January?
No, the only thing I saw was up to, I think, late December of 23.
Okay, so there are confidential things that are in our communications because I was not aware that after he received that there were not. So the prosecutor who obtained these, her protocol would not be to stop and ask the court for some guidance on this, maybe do an in-camera review. If she's subjecting herself to client privileged communications, instead of reading them and finding out and assessing for herself if there are anything in there that's confidential information between me and my appeals attorney, I have no other way to communicate with him when I'm in this incarcerated situation because I was brought here to Arizona to deal with these charges. So it is a problem. It's a problem that she took them. It's a problem that she got them from MCSO. It's a problem that she read through them. It's a huge problem that she put some of them into her motion and now his IP address is exposed to the public, which is a federal offense. There's a lot of things wrong with what has happened here.
Well, you reminded me that when his number was approved, he then sent messages from different IP addresses instead of that phone number that was privileged. So he's the one that disclosed or violated the confidential nature. I don't see that any of these, I'm going to call them inadvertently intercepted messages between you and your appeal attorney. I don't see that they're being used in any way by the state.
Just the state reading them as a violation of the client-attorney privilege.
Well, not if they're not done through a privileged setup the way that they were supposed to, which he even acknowledged.
My understanding from my perspective was that that phone number was now privileged. The way it comes to me on the tablet is I text that phone number or I call that phone number.
Correct. So, if you're communicating through the phone number, but if he has it set up where the messages aren't being sent and received actually through the phone number, but through different IP addresses, they wouldn't, the system doesn't know that they're privileged because they're not being sent and received through that privileged number.
But I didn't know that. There's no way for me to know that from where I am in my cell. There's no understanding for that. I assumed he was just getting them on his same phone that we were having client attorney privileged communications. And is the state giving these to Idaho? Do these get dispersed out? I would like to know that. Where are these going? They're getting them from MCSO. Is there a subpoena to get these from MCSO? Is there a warrant to get these from MCSO? I didn't see anything that warrants them getting them from MCSO in the first place.
All right, let me hear from the state.
Your Honor, I think that the state's motion really covers the law under this. The defendant and her attorney were provided with information. Whether or not she understood it or not, her attorney understood that it was phone calls that were covered. So it's not just the defendant who is not complying with following the correct procedure to utilize the set up attorney-client privilege means to communicate. In this case, the state, obviously, I disclose those before I even look at them. I understand that they are statements by a defendant, and I believe that they are to be disclosed under Rule 15. And so before I even look at them, I send them to the defendant because I don't have the option of not providing them to her since they have been obtained. I think if you apply the case law in this, the defendant cannot meet her burden to show that there's any legal advice in these messages. There's no privilege in them. The messages are asking to set up times to call and to speak.
Are the three, I think it's three messages that you included in your response, are those all the messages?
No, Your Honor, there are other messages, and we do say that tablet messages between Ms. Daybell and Mr. Jerram do not end on December 28th. They continue.
And there is privilege information on them going forward. And the state is basically testifying for my attorney now. She just testified for my attorney that he understood that they were these were not privileged communications. Where does she understand that where is she testifying for my attorney?
Well, I think because of the context of the messages say, I'm trying to schedule a time and I'm trying to set up a confidential line, meaning
that was
this
before
is not confidential.
That's right. He said it wasn't confidential before MCSO gave him a letter saying your phone number is now confidential. Your phone number
I'm not going to keep rehashing this with you. The fact that he's using different IP addresses and not messaging through the actual phone number that's protected, I think is part of the problem. So if he's not using the program correctly, that's an issue you need to take up with your attorney.
How is he using it incorrectly?
I just told you. He's not messaging through the phone number. He's using different IP.
How can you message other than the phone number? I don't understand that.
I don't understand that either. But if it was from the phone number and it's for his cell phone, for example, it would be the same IP address for each communication. There's like four or five IP addresses.
Where are the IP addresses coming from? They're given to you by the state?
They're right there listed on the messages.
I'm just saying, where are they obtaining those from?
From your attorney's messages to you?
From MCSO?
Yeah.
Did they get IP addresses for every single person of every single message communication on the text from MCSO?
Well, it's listed on the messages, so I assume so. It says Craig Durham, and then under it is the IP address from the device that's being used.
Okay, and then Ms. K is reading all of these messages, and they're not privileged. Is that what you're coming to?
They're not privileged if you're not using the program or your attorney's not using the program correctly. Okay, they're still not going to be allowed to use any of these messages. What I'm saying is they're inadvertent disclosure by MCSO because someone's not using the program correctly doesn't mean that they had bad faith in how they got them.
How is he using it incorrectly?
I don't know how else to explain it to you. I've told you 5 different times now. So he's not messaging with the phone number. He's messaging from different IP addresses.
Okay. Can I ask if these messages are being disseminated anywhere to Idaho, to the prosecutors in Idaho? Because that's definitely affecting my appeal if that's the case.
I don't know.
Have not been sent to anyone other than the defendant, Your Honor.
All right. So there was some communications, I find, that were intercepted between Ms. Daybell and her attorney. The state's not to use those communications. They're not to disseminate those communications, but I do find that they weren't purposely sought out by the state. And that dismissal isn't the appropriate sanction if there is an appropriate sanction. It's ordered denying the motion to dismiss for violation of confidential communication. All right, then we have defendant's motion to dismiss for prosecutorial misconduct dated March 21st. Let me get that. And the state's response. The motion to dismiss for prosecutorial misconduct was filed on March 21. The response, I don't see a date on the response, but I do have the response. Did you get that response? Ms. Daybell, did you get that response?
I did, Your Honor.
All right. So your prior attorneys had... let me back up. The state filed a motion back in, I think it was September of 2024, asking the court to preclude your defense team at the time from making public records requests through Gilbert and or Chandler police departments. I denied the state's request, saying that the defense is free to do their investigation and make public records requests through appropriate means. So that's part of your complaint, that they didn't provide those public documents to the defense. That's sort of a civil issue, I guess, but let me hear your argument on that.
That isn't really the complaint itself.
That's your first paragraph.
I know, but the complaint is that...
I'd like to take each allegation and deal with them one at a time.
I understand that. My complaint is the interference by the state, Ms. K in particular, in stopping that and interfering with us trying to investigate and do our own investigation. It is a violation of the constitutional right and due process. And she did do it, and she did do it purposefully. And then after she did it, and we weren't allowed to have anything from either of the police departments. Then she filed her motion, and then later, the day that I was Rule 11, that is the day after when you said that you denied that motion. So I don't know what she did or what she said to Chandler and Gilbert to stop them from giving us any information, but as soon as we put in a request, we were cut off. No information. You can't have anything. That's when I was trying to, the big video that we're trying to get in Gilbert, that's what I was trying to request. I tried to request that myself because I would have my investigator to go and explain what that was and why we didn't have it. And so we were precluded from doing all those things by the state. They should not be interfering with that. That's one of the reasons why everything has taken so long. We haven't been given things we've asked the state for. We haven't been given them. We tried to get them from Chandler and Gilbert. We can't get them from them. She's stopping us from getting from them. How are you supposed to put together a defense?
So when your prior defense counsel put in that request back in September, the state says that they obtained those information and gave it to your attorneys on October 1. So why are we waiting until March to address this if you had an issue with that?
I have had an issue with it the whole time.
Why didn't someone file a motion back in after, December, November, January, February, saying they had an issue with this?
I did. These are in my motions to you for specific discovery. I discussed this exact problem.
Okay. Well, now you're saying it arises to prosecutorial misconduct.
It is.
Right. This is the first I've been made aware of that, as far as I know, that the police department never honored the public records request. If they don't honor a public records request, there's a process to go through regarding that.
Which is what?
I'm not going to give you legal advice. All right. Your second allegation, the prosecutorial misconduct, we've already kind of dealt with, that she distributed the state distributed attorney-client privileged communication. We've discussed that. The next one is legal advice to defense witness Nate Eaton. We've somewhat discussed that, but I think their motion, the state says that they simply notified him that he would need to be served with a subpoena to have to appear in court. So how is that improper?
It's taking her word for that's what happened. She's not under oath saying that that's what happened. Nate Eaton's not here to testify that that's what happened. They're the only two parties that are there to say that that is what happened. So that is my problem with it. I would like for one of them to get on the stand and say exactly what happened in that conversation and that she wasn't giving him legal advice. How do we know that she wasn't? It's a very curious situation that he called her and then he writes in his motion this statement that obviously comes from Ms. Kay. She seems to be a clear attempt by Ms. Daybell to use the rules of criminal procedure as a pretext simply to keep me out of the courtroom and interfere with my ability to report. We also don't know if he told her, don't come to the March 18th hearing because that's when they're going to serve you with your subpoena. So all these things come from there, and we don't know who's saying it, and you're just taking her word for it like you took her word for, oh, there's only six emails and there's no other emails. You're just taking her word for it as an officer of the court, and I think that she should have to be sworn in.
Well, you want me to just take your word for he must have gotten these things from Ms. Kay, okay? Just because his motion says he thinks that you're noticing him as a witness to keep him out of the courtroom? I don't know why you'd take the jump to that is coming from Ms. Kay as opposed to his own volition. He also hired an attorney that said the same thing. Even if she had said you need to be served with a subpoena to have to show up in court, that is not an ethical violation.
Well, giving legal advice is an ethical violation. Is that correct?
Stating what the law is not an ethical violation. If she said, I don't think you should show up at court, even if you're subpoenaed or something like that, that could be an ethical violation, but we don't have that.
How do we know we don't have that? That's my question. How do we know what went on in that conversation if it wasn't recorded? Aren't witness
You can interview him. You can interview Mr. Eaton. Your investigator can interview Mr. Eaton. So when and if you get that information from Mr. Eaton that something nefarious happened in that conversation, bring it up then. But you're jumping to conclusions. You have the right to interview any witness, okay?
Not a witness anymore because you just precluded him.
All right. You can interview him. You can have your investigator interview him.
So that's, even though he's not a noticed witness now, we can still interview him and try to find this information because we can't get it now? Is that what you're saying?
Sure. Have your investigator call him. Ask him about the conversation. At this time, I'm going to, based on just the pleadings, I'm denying the motion to dismiss for prosecutorial misconduct.
Of course.
All right, 609 motion. The state's alleged a total of 7 felony convictions in the state of Idaho. Under Rule 609, the court finds that limiting the number of convictions and the nature of the convictions to be appropriate as to not be overly prejudicial. There is an interest in allowing a jury to know that the defendant's been convicted of at least one felony. But let me hear, I'm inclined to probably limit it to 2 felonies in order that they be sanitized. Does the state want to be heard on that?
Your Honor, I do believe that the court should allow for at least 3. There are multiple dates and multiple victims in those and multiple different distinct incidents. And I believe that it would be appropriate to, when we're talking about the credibility of the defendant, to allowing in 3 of those.
I looked at the date ranges and I looked at the actual counts, and some of the counts, obviously the laws are titled differently in Idaho, but there's a couple of counts that specifically have what I would call dishonesty built into the name of the conviction, the first degree murder and grand theft by deception. Those are counts 1 and 3, specifically. And again, these only become relevant if the defendant chooses to testify. I did read the defendant's response asking that all of them be precluded. Let me hear from the defendant.
One second, Your Honor. Your Honor, I haven't had a time to, I wasn't planning on talking about the 609 today, so I'll just refer to my reply.
Well, we can table it till later in the trial because, again, it doesn't become relevant unless you choose to testify, but you know my inclination and what the state's argument is.
Okay.
This morning I handed each side proposed preliminary instructions. We don't need to discuss those now, but depending on tomorrow how far we get in the jury selection process, maybe you can be prepared to tell me if you object to any or if there are additions or corrections that need to be made. All right, I think that's going to be it for today, but let me check with the state. Is there anything else we need to address today?
I think just for the record, Your Honor, in terms of allowing in witnesses, the gallery. I think that you had indicated you would reserve one row for the next of kin.
Yeah, let's discuss that. We're going to put up signage after we complete jury selection. So the first row on both sides behind defense counsel and behind the state will be reserved for immediate family members, next of kin, those sorts of people, relatives. The very last row on both sides will be reserved for media. And then the middle rows in between those two will be kind of a first come, first serve general public viewing area. Any questions about that?
I do just want to make sure that, assuming we are leaving on the defendant's mother, father, sister.
Well, if they're potential witnesses, they won't be in here.
The state will be invoking the rule of exclusion.
Do you understand that, Ms. Daybell?
I do.
All right. So as long as people that we haven't already addressed other than Mr. Eaton remain on the witness list, the rule of exclusion would be in fact, it means that they won't be allowed in the courtroom except for your investigator can be in the courtroom. And they're precluded from talking to anyone about their testimony or other testimony until they're released as witnesses. Anything else from the state for today?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
All right. Anything from the defense for today?
A couple of things, Your Honor. We need to discuss the
How the division would like the media exhibits.
What?
How the division would like the media exhibits, if we're presenting recordings or audio, individual flash drives for each exhibit. There was
depends on how you're going to present them, but I would say, yeah, probably one flash drive per recording or exhibit.
And then I'm guessing three copies, one for state, one for...
I don't know that you need copies if you've already disclosed it to them. Just tell them what it is when we're marking it and tell the clerk what it is with the description so it's clear on the exhibit list which exhibit is what.
One more thing, Your Honor. I wanted a clarification. In your minute entry dated the 25th regarding the defendant's motion to remove restraints. So my understanding when I read what was from MCSO, and then you put in here, however, at the sheriff's discretion, one or more armed sheriff deputies may be positioned near the exits. So what their recommendation was the minimal amount of restraints, meaning if there was going to be an armed guard, then they would not have to do the belt. So I was confused by and wanted a clarification on what you were actually ordering, because the DOs had a question about it with me this morning. So
I ordered that you don't have to wear the leg restraint, but that you do have to wear the rack belt, because that is not going to be visible to the jury. The leg restraint's a little more cumbersome and visible, and since you're representing yourself and you're going to need to approach the podium and those sorts of things, I ordered the removal of the leg restraint. You will, though, wear the rack belt. And then I said it's up to the sheriff's office if they want to. They can position a couple deputies in the back if they want additional deputies.
Well, their recommendation was that you wouldn't have to use the belt at all if they had the armed guard.
I read their response and their recommendation, and that's my order.
So what is it exactly?
That you have to wear the rack belt but not the leg restraint.
And that they will or will not have armed guard?
It's up to them.
Okay.
All right, so tomorrow we're going to start at 10:30 with going through the answers on the questionnaires that the walk-in jurors will fill out in the morning. And then in the afternoon, we'll have in-person voir dire of those potential jurors. The court's going to seal the FTR tomorrow for the portion of the in-person answers of the jurors. which should be from 1:30 on. All right, we'll be at recess.
That's the latest, Lori Vallow-Daybell in the courtroom. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. You don't miss any of our continuing coverage on this case and the others we're following for you right here at True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.
This has been a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.